Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
It's Radio K's Real College Podcast. I'm Patrick Sharkey. Our episode today, presented in three stories, is all about language, the way we communicate with one another and express ourselves. For instance, I'm speaking to you now in the English language, and I'm expressing to you that our show is beginning. We have stories about the FCC, a story on computational linguistics, different languages within the same romantic relationships, and we have an interview with a linguistics professor here at the University of Minnesota. All of that coming your way right now for the next half hour right here on Radio K. Legendary comedian George Carlin infamously goofed on the FCC's seven dirty words, but you'd be surprised what words aren't banned. Reporter Max Fuller takes a look into the FCC's stance on racial slurs, specifically, and yes, we're going there, the N-word.
I'd like to start this story off with a little fun fact about myself. My favorite word in the English language is the N-word. And by N-word, I mean nigga. The fact that us black people took a word that was created specifically to be dehumanizing, demoralizing, and downright disgusting toward us and transform it into what many black and brown people view as a term of endearment, brotherhood, and solidarity, that right there is the coolest thing in the freaking world to me. Not to mention, I also get some satisfaction out of knowing white people aren't supposed to say nigga anymore. Now, you're probably sitting there wondering, how am I even allowed to say the word nigga on air? You would think that such a vile word would be censored by our good old buddies at the FCC, right?
Wrong.
In fact, the FCC doesn't regulate any racial slurs or epitaphs. In this current age of censorship and political correctness, how is it even possible that words such as nigga and a whole host of other slurs aren't regulated? Well, I called the FCC up for some answers, and here's what they had to say.
Hello, we are not available now. Please leave your name and phone number after the beep. We will return your call.
Okay, well, that didn't work out as planned, but I gotta give them a break. They're probably busy trying to find a new chairman, as their former chairman, Tom Wheeler, formally announced his resignation earlier this December. So it looks like we're gonna have to put on our journalist hats and find the answers for ourselves. While the FCC has no official stance on regulating racial slurs, they do regulate obscene content. And obscene content is defined as something that lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, describes sexual content, and something that the, quote, average person, unquote, would find offensive. The FCC also prohibits profane content, which is defined as language that is so offensive to the public that it is causing a nuisance. So, essentially, in the eyes of the FCC, it's more offensive to talk about sex than it is to say any racial slur you can think of. Now, of course, it's not like you can go around calling people every racial slur under the sun on TV or radio, as that could fall into the categories of slander or editorializing, which the FCC does regulate. However, as there is no official stance on the usage of racial slurs, there is the potential for loopholes, such as context. Which is basically why I could even do this story in the first place. Or perhaps why we've seen several times throughout this year the word nigga being uncensored on national television, on American Crime Story, or during Dave Chappelle's recent monologue on Saturday Night Live.
Let me put it simply. Are you saying under oath that you have not addressed any black person as a nigger or spoken about black people as niggers in the past 10 years, Detective Furman?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Oh my God. This is insane.
Can you say the word nigger on TV?
And the Cincinnati police said shooting that gorilla was the toughest decision this department ever had to make. I said, well, you about to see a lot of niggers in gorilla costumes in Cincinnati.
Despite my personal opinion on the word nigga, myself and many other black and brown people still find the word incredibly offensive. No matter what type of evolution the word has taken over the last several years, it still carries as bloody a history as any word in the English language. So why is it that the FCC hasn't officially put the word on the infamous list of banned words? I mean, it's not like you can use in a context and get away with it. remember that the FCC regulations use the phrase, quote, something the average person would find offensive, unquote. If the FCC is defining the, quote, average person as your everyday white person, then they actually might have a point. Hell, as we've seen in recent events, the use of racial slurs might actually get you some votes in office. But if the FCC is including black and brown people in their definition of the average person, how could the word nigga or any other racial slur not officially be banned? At the end of the day, only the FCC knows. Who knows? Maybe I'll get my own call from the FCC because of this story and we'll get some answers out of it. But until then, for the Real College Podcast, I am a nigga named Max Fuller.
I'm Amy, and this week I spoke with someone extremely knowledgeable about the Ojibwe language. Brendan Fairbanks is an assistant professor of American Indian Studies right here at the University of Minnesota. He carries a PhD in linguistics and is author of Ojibwe Discourse Markers, published this year, and is editor of Chume Winsha, Ojibwe Stories from Leech Lake.
There are things and music and spirituality, and there are many cultural things that you will never see in your whole life, even though it's happening in your own backyard. But I think in the United States, people don't realize how much language is part of your identity. Because in the United States, most people are monolingual.
How does that play into your personal life? Did you grow up speaking Ojibwe?
I didn't grow up speaking it. Because my dad didn't. He didn't speak it. But I learned it by hanging out with elders. So I didn't, you know, take a bunch of classes per se. I used to go to like community language tables where they were teaching it or whatever, but never quite learned too much there. It's not until I started hanging out with the elders that I learned how to speak it and how they speak it, and just learned a tremendous amount of language from the elders.
So now that you are a language professor at the U of M, how do you feel about the differences between learning from the elders and learning in a traditional classroom setting?
Learning in classrooms, it does present some limitations because classrooms are or can be quite sterile, because life is our inspiration for speaking the language. You can't just be learning certain romantic ideas about what we think Ojibwe culture is. It's about everyday life too.
How would you describe the interactions in the English language versus the Ojibwe language?
Many bilingual people will tell you that when you speak one language, if they speak two or three different languages, they'll say, well, when I speak this language, it makes me think this way. And when I speak this other language, I think another way. Because every language has its way of cutting up the same reality, right? If you're monolingual, and it's usually what's called the blindness of monolingualism, is if you only know one language, you think the whole world thinks like you do. You think the whole world cuts up reality like you do. But when you start learning another language, there are things that just don't translate. But when we start getting to third and fourth year at the U of M, I try to help them to start thinking in Ojibwe.
Was there a switch for you when you started thinking in Ojibwe?
Yes, there was. It's interesting. I tell my students this all the time. When you're learning another language, your brain will fight you for a while. But after you do it a while, you know, usually around, it depends on how much you're practicing the language and you're in it, but usually around 3 to 5 years or even maybe up to 7 years, but your brain will fight you for a while and it'll just be really hard and hard and hard. And then you'll wake up and it'll just be easy and it'll just start coming out easily. My brain said, I'm tired of fighting you on this. Let's just speak Ojibwe now. And that's what I tell my students, is I said, you know, because sometimes I make them get up and talk in front of the whole class about a story, and they're kind of exhibiting a lot of processing effort and thinking, and it's not coming out fluidly. And I tell them, I said, don't worry about it. Your comprehension will come first. And I said, one day you'll just wake up and you'll be able to speak it.
And how cool to be able to witness that switch as a professor and have that unique perspective on the students, and one day they just get it, and it must just be a really magical moment for you, I can imagine. So you spent a lot of time with the elders, you said, when you were learning Ojibwe. What other kinds of traditions did you learn about from them, or kinds of stories that you heard?
In dominant culture, when you give somebody the middle finger, right, that's pretty serious, right? In Ojibwe, you do it by doing this, right? With the five-finger gesture in your face.
Kind of like a firework out of your hand.
Kind of. But this right here is equivalent to giving someone the middle finger.
Brandon, stop. I'm offended. What is your Ojibwe name?
Awanigabo. Awanigabo means standing fog.
Where do you get that name from?
Usually for Ojibwe's, like, babies don't get named immediately after birth. In Minnesota, to get an Ojibwe name, it usually doesn't come from the parents. It comes from an elder or somebody you ask who has the ability or the authority, right, who has the power to give names. In other words, they had a dream or they saw something significant when they were young.
I can tell you have so much passion talking about the Ojibwe language and the Ojibwe culture. What makes you proud of the culture and the language?
Well, that's just who I am. You know, I'm an Ojibwe, and we're in a struggle and a fight to keep our language and preserve it in a climate which does not value diversity. What people don't realize is that there are over 500 Native American tribes in the United States, over 500 languages in the United States. So people think, oh, English is the only language here. It's not. Ojibwe is being spoken right under your noses here and has been spoken here for hundreds of years.
So you talk about the beauty of the culture. Does it make you worried in the coming years about what will happen to it?
We're kind of in this endangered state for our language, for example, and our culture, but things are looking up. There are kids that are learning their language. We have immersion schools. We have one in Ojibwe Dakota Immersion School in Minneapolis. They're teaching the children over there. Some of our own students are teaching their kids at home. You know, so there's a lot of things that we're still dealing with, but things are turning around, you know. So I'm excited for the future, and I'm excited to see, you know, 20, 30 years where we are with our culture. Because I'm frankly getting tired of saying our language is endangered. I want to start saying that our language is prospering. And I think it's beginning to, you know.
And you're helping that by being a professor. Is there anything else that you would like the students and staff at the U of M to know about the Ojibwe language and culture?
I think our program here at the U of M, we have 4 years of Ojibwe instruction. And that's brand new. Last year was the first time we ever had 4 years of instruction. And we just created a bachelor's degree in Ojibwe language program. And that's brand new as of this year, too. And we're also creating an Ojibwe immersion house. In fact, we've already created it, and it's going to happen in the fall, next fall of 2017, where our students can live together and only speak Ojibwe. And they'll live together for 9 months, right? That's exciting. That's brand new. And I'm excited to see how far that will take their language development. We're not just trying to expose our students to Ojibwe language. We are trying to create Ojibwe speakers.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. Would you mind signing off in the Ojibwe language?
Yeah. Migo gainin, minwain daman ma, bishayan je anuj je gwejimian, minwain dana pachi Ojibwe mayan, minwain ge je Ojibwe motoba guan ge kano ma gnag ma. Ibe kain da so wega migong. Mino agae, ni min wain dan. Wab magwan go, yekino maga ni nanik, ni tau jibwe mwad. Mino agae ji kain da mwad o, ni din wai win nan. Ga mi nigu is young ni shna bae wiong. Ah, mi manik miyo.
This is Amy for Real College Podcast.
Howdy, this is Will Bjørndal for Real College Podcast, and it's time for the question of the week. The makers of the Oxford English Dictionary recently announced the 2016 Word of the Year, their choice being post-truth. I was curious to see what Twin Cities Land USA's Word of the Year was, so I traversed the bustling centers of commerce and the darkest corners
of Twin Cities Land, USA, asking, what is your word of the year?
Okay, so for me, my word of the year has been queen. However, it is spelled K-W-E-E-N, and it is the highest form of praise that I can give to a person.
Beautiful, thank you. What about you?
My word of the year is risk, because I took a lot of risk this year with fundraising for the first time and producing and writing, so that's my word.
My word of the year 2016 would probably be reckless.
Why is that?
Well, the word reckless I use a lot, and I feel like it can describe a lot of things. In particular, something that's kind of out of hand and spiraling out of control. And I think that that accurately kind of describes 2016 for me.
That would describe my 2016 as well.
Yeah, very true.
Now, if you had to pick your word of the year, what would it be?
Oh, man. I'm really focused on that sort of thing.
It does any word doesn't need to be like a brand new word, just your word of the year.
Opportunity.
I'm trying to think of what my 13-year-old uses all the time. When I'm driving, he says skirt.
Skirt.
Meaning that, you know, as you're going around a corner, the car goes skirt. It's the only thing I can think of.
Post-neoliberal capitalism. I think there's a clear global crisis of capitalism that's rooted in a variety of neoliberal reforms that were supposed to open up the world to allow for the increasing dominance of multinational corporations. And I think that that neoliberal capitalist model is in crisis. And that is evident by the resurgence of populism of both the left and the right around the globe.
That has been our question of the week. For Real College Podcast, I am William Bjørndal.
Love, intimacy, relationships, dating. Most of the time, those kind of things are pretty complicated, right? We all know that simply saying something like, I love you, isn't always cut and dry. Now think about couples navigating their thoughts and feelings with language barriers. Let's hear from Jennifer Liu and Ling Bui, who met on Tinder about a year ago.
So I can see his name on Tinder profile. That's not a like American name. So I just assume that he's not from here. So it's expected that he's not a native speaker of English. My native languages are Chinese and Shanghainese, and I started English in the first grade in elementary school. And I started German when I was 15.
Yes, similarly, I speak Vietnamese as my native language, but I also start learning English as elementary school, I think, as well. I came here for college, so I've been here for 7 years, so hopefully I can communicate.
Once you found out that you had different first languages, did you worry about that at all, or what kind of went through your mind?
I guess I'm the one who worried about this. I worried a lot about this in the beginning. Because I think communication is so important, and I was concerned that both of us have to speak a second language instead of a lot of situations where one person can speak their native language and the other can speak a second language.
Personally, I don't feel worried about that, but maybe just because I don't really think about it beforehand. I felt that a lot of my understanding and like emotional expression actually came from my college time. So I felt that I can express myself actually much better in English than in my native language. I feel that, for example, I can say thank you or I'm sorry or I love you, for example, much easier in English than in my native language for some reason. Actually, I'm coming to Shanghai this winter I'm going home this winter, and then on my way from back from home to the US, I'm going to stop by Shanghai for like 3 days. And I think I'm going to meet her parents, and I'm very nervous actually.
I don't think he needs to like be nervous about it, because he can just, you know, say whatever he wants, and I'm the one who needs to like cover for it, you know. And it's very difficult to be a be a interpreter.
That's why I thought that we can, you know, make up script beforehand.
Yeah, you see what my problem is right now. So like Vietnam is probably the most culturally similar country to China.
So a lot of things we actually know, we both know what it is, but we cannot find the English equivalent to describe it.
So do you have any advice for people who are going through the same kind of thing?
I think first of all, don't feel stressed out or frustrated when you cannot express. I think some people say that you are actually a lot more creative than you give yourself credit for. So in any circumstance, if you slow down, think for it for a second, you were going to find a way to express what you want to say. It's not going to be 100%, but at least you're going to get your idea out. When you feel that you don't want, you cannot talk, it is actually the time that you need to talk the most.
Camila Marino Franco is a student at the University of Minnesota. She moved here from Columbia about 6 years ago and is dating an American guy. Here's what she had to say.
In Spanish, there are two different words for I love you. There's one that's like, I love you, but like you say it to your friends, or you say when you're just first dating somebody. And then there's another one, te amo. And that's when you say like when you're with somebody for a long time or like to your parents. It's super strong. Saying that to somebody is like this huge thing, at least for me it was. And when I first began dating, he like said it to me and I was like, no. You don't know what that is. You can't do that. I feel like other thing language-wise is that I couldn't date somebody or I couldn't be with somebody who didn't at least want to learn Spanish. I just couldn't. Just because it's very tied to the Spanish language. And I feel like when I'm speaking English, it kind of waters down my feelings and it's not exactly what I mean and it's not exactly who I am. I feel like I'm two different people in Spanish or in English. I think it's really hard because he doesn't speak that much Spanish and there's a lot of things that end up being unsaid. And I'm kind of just like waiting for him to like learn more and share that whole other part. Like, they really have to want to learn about it and they really have to want to experience it more or to eat the food and they have to want to speak the language and all that stuff. And he had that stuff. Like, yes, there are challenges and there are differences, but as long as he wants to learn about it, then, like, that's okay.
So, Tiferet Pena is also a student at the University of Minnesota. And she talked to me a little bit about her mom, who's from the Dominican Republic. And she made the conscious decision, actually, to date someone who wasn't Latino.
When my mom started dating again, she actually went the online route. So she had an eHarmony account. Those fun things. So they met that way. You know, Latin culture is very, you know, connected to dance and music, and my mom loves to dance and, you know, salsa, merengue, you know, bachata. He doesn't know those dances and also doesn't feel comfortable or just in general doesn't enjoy dancing, which I think makes my mom like kind of sad because she'll like end up sitting with him and everyone else is dancing and missing out on that part of her culture. So my mom generally speaks Spanish in the home. Her partner lived with us for a while, and I think that at sometimes was frustrating because she would speak Spanish to us and he would get frustrated, or at the dinner table and he would be like, why can't you just speak English? Because he wouldn't understand what was going on, and that was frustrating. Not that her partner hasn't made sacrifices, but she's sacrificing some of her culture and language to be in this relationship. I don't know if she sees it that way. It's hard to have a very personal relationship with someone who you have trouble communicating with.
So here's Megan Califitt with a few last words of advice. She's an Aurora Center advocate who will talk about communicating in healthy relationships no matter what language you use.
You have to take yourself out of your own brain, basically, and just think, okay, this is how I'm thinking, but you need to be selfless and understand that this person is coming from different experiences, bring a lot of empathy into the game, and just even ask them. You know, it's like, ask them, okay, if I say this, what does this make you feel? Or like, what do you think when I say this? Even showing that you care enough to understand how the other person operates really helps more than you could imagine, I would say.
This was Real College Podcast featuring Jay Chu, a Taiwanese artist. My name is Haley Matterham, and thanks for listening.
Milk and cereal, peanut butter and jelly, macaroni and cheese. For a lot of people, these combinations are examples of things that just seem to go together. So let's talk about a new pairing, computers and language. According to a quick Google search, computational linguistics can be pretty self-explanatory. Honestly, I could just define it as the understanding of a language from a computer science perspective. But after talking to a couple of people in the Hughes Institute of Linguistics, I found that this field is so much more than just a Google search.
And because of my previous computer science background, I feel like, oh, there is a very sensible way to combine computer science and linguistics together. I feel like it's maybe a new methodology to do linguistics research.
Meet Bree, a first-year PhD student here at the Hughes Institute of Linguistics. In the past, Bree has studied educational technology as an undergraduate student in China. She's also studied teaching English as a second language in the U.S. Here, at the U, she focuses on theoretical linguistics. In an interview a couple of weeks ago, Bree explained how useful her background in computer science has been in her studies. One of the biggest methods Bree talked about was machine learning. Machine learning is teaching a computer to recognize and predict patterns on its own without human assistance. Bree said linguists can save time studying language patterns by teaching computers to analyze sentences by themselves.
Once you notice some pattern in a language, you want to see more. You want to see, okay, I have 10 sentences. I know what's going on in this 10 sentences with the rule I have in my mind. But machine learning, this method, can help me see a lot of sentences. Are they follow the same pattern, or there's anything going on wrong? I should modify or change something in my previous set of rules.
Computer science methods can be used to study patterns in linguistics. Bree also says that the same is true in reverse. Certain tools in linguistics can be useful in computer science.
I just feel like the way we draw trees are a way to represent some data.
By trees, Bree means syntax trees, which are used in linguistics to organize sentence structures. Bree says these trees can be used to organize data in a corpus, or a database of language.
So the general purpose of having a tree structure to represent language is we want to disambiguate non-ambiguous data. A structured corpus can maybe serve more research purposes.
I also got to speak with Luke, an undergraduate student here in the linguistics department. There's not really a computational linguistics major, but Luke says his department offers a class. Luke says he learned a lot about the field through a research position.
I got my start in computational linguistics about a year and a half ago. I got a research position in the natural language processing and information extraction group. It's kind of a mouthful, but basically what they do is computational linguistics applied to the medical field. So they try to help doctors. The end goal is to try to help doctors and other people in the medical field process all of the information coming out of the hospital records, which you can imagine is a ton.
According to Luke, computational linguistics is an interdisciplinary field with many, many different domains. While Luke's research position deals with the medical domain, he was also able to tell me about some different areas.
What's interesting, too, is that the different subdomains, like I said, come from different kinds of language. So, like, the kinds of language that doctors use is different from the one that normal people use or people in the financial sector. All of that, they're going to have a lot of specific abbreviations and vocabulary. So the different domains can be very widespread, but it's usually about the kind of language you're looking at.
We also talked about artificial intelligence. If computational linguistics is getting a computer to understand language like we can, then artificial intelligence is getting a computer to think like we can.
So a computer has to know how to adapt. That's the main point about this field, is making computers adaptable like humans are, you know.
Luke brought up this role of teaching computers adaptability a lot throughout our interview. For example, with Siri, researchers are teaching a computer how to recognize speech.
That's actually a different domain that uses computational linguistics methods to understand what's going on when you try to talk to a phone, say. So when you, and that's called speech recognition. And so you could say a whole lot of kind of different things to that, your phone, right? And usually when we talk to Siri, we kind of have like choppy, simple language, right? And it makes sense because we want it to be easy for Siri to understand us. But the goal, obviously, is to have a computer that can interact with us just like any other human would.
And for anyone who's afraid of computational linguistics going too far, Luke says not to worry.
I think it really is interesting to talk to someone who isn't in the field about computers and especially AI, because it's so mysterious, and people are probably even scared about it, you know, the potential for computers to understand us and spy on us and everything. But I guess to those people, I would say, at least right now, don't worry, because although we're making a lot of progress, you know, it's just fine-tuning the math and coming up with better computer algorithms to get there. So, but I would really encourage people to learn about this stuff, because it is going to be, I mean, it already is very widely used.
So how can people become more aware of computational linguistics? Well, Luke mentioned YouTube videos. He also said that if you can get beyond the academic language, papers have been very useful. But I really liked this idea a lot.
I guess what I would suggest, too, is thinking about the kinds of tools or technologies that you could build, like a new idea for that, and then go see what might be already out there. And if there's nothing, then go see what's similar. That's what's cool about this, is if you start learning even a little bit, you know, even if you don't know math or whatever, you can start coming up with cool ideas and see if they're already being worked on. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think it's pretty cool, too. For Real College Podcast, this has been Emily Allen.
And that's our show. Amy Fulahi, Emily Allen, Will Bjorndahl, Max Fuller, and Haley Matterham all contributed to today's show. Real College Podcast is produced by Jacob Maldonado Medina, Emily Allen, Emily LePain, and Max Fuller. The show is edited by me, Patrick Sharkey, and we will be off for the next 2 weeks, but we promise to bring you some really fun and fascinating shows in the new year. Have a great holiday, and we'll see you in 2017.